Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Like most of the country, Tucson implemented racist and discriminatory housing practices during the 20th century. Joel Turner was a native of Tucson who grew up in the Dunbar neighborhood in the 1930s and 40s. After graduating from the University of Arizona with a chemistry degree, serving in the Korean War, and graduating from dental school in Tennessee, he returned to Tucson in 1965 and began looking for a place to live.
Some areas I could not buy in. I looked at some houses over back towards the Arizona Inn. You had a lot of houses in there for sale. They wouldn't sell them to me. Oh, no, they wouldn't sell that to me. I used to go through there all the time. Guy would look at me and shuddering. I mean, they didn't want to sell to an Afro-American. They didn't want you in there. I was lucky to buy the house I bought. I had purchased a house in the vicinity of Grant and Country Club. And we were in a completely white neighborhood. There were no Afro-Americans in that neighborhood at that time. At the very beginning, a man came down who lived in the vicinity and indicated that he came down to see if we were registered to vote. And I said, yes, we are, as a matter of fact. And then he proceeded to tell me that they had a covenant. I said, what is that? Well, you're not supposed to be living here. I said, well, I'm here. I bought the house. I have two guns, which I will use, starting with you, if necessary. And then I told him to leave, which he did. My neighbors right next to me, they were very cordial. And the neighbor next to them was very cordial. And we never had any problems in the neighborhood after that, none. Nobody bothered me. Nobody said hello. That didn't bother me. I didn't care if they spoke to me or didn't speak to me, because I didn't come there to speak to them. I came there to live.
That story was produced by Angus Anderson and comes from the UA Library Special Collections Archive Tucson Oral History Project. Unfortunately, Turner's story isn't unique.
Context of white supremacy. Of course, Mr. Turner's story is not unique. We wouldn't have a system of racism, white supremacy, if it was. This is our book club final session. I think Mr. Demery Poor and some of our other listeners are rejoicing. We are all done. James Loewen, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. And in fact, we are all done, and we will do one session and be done. There is no second audio segment today. We were closing on the finish last week, so we'll have one 60-minute session like we normally would, and that will be it. So think of all of your final thoughts, concluding points. I thought it was important, Mr. Turner's report. We got that. Thomas in New York shared that report from Arizona Public Radio last week on the compensatory call-in, because it deals exactly with what we've been talking about in Mr. Lowen's book for the past couple of months. I appreciated so much Mr. Turner being another example of counter-violence, having his firearm. I am not just going to hold hands and sing songs and invite white people to come spend the night at my house overnight and hope that that will serve as ample security. No way. I will take my defense, my safety into my own hands. Love it. Love it. Love it. And I think there has been a dearth of that in the book. I think someone pointed that out at the very beginning, paying attention to examples where black people are not just the victims of terrorism, but also fighting back, showing some agency, as they say. Anywho, we will go ahead and get started. All done. Context of White Supremacy, James Lowen's Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism, audio segment number one.
African-American challenges to sundown towns. Even well-meaning whites can't desegregate a sundown town without the help of black households. This book hopes to spur action to end sundown towns, suburbs, and neighborhoods, and some of that action can be taken only by African Americans. I believe a black family, backed by an alert civil rights attorney if necessary, can now buy a home in most of America's persisting sundown towns. Some towns would still meet them with a freeze-out or violence, but black families have increasingly found welcoming neighbors. Admittedly, moving into a sundown town differs from any other civil rights action. Unlike the marcher or sit-in participant of years past, the black family moving into a sundown town eats and sleeps on the picket line and risks all its members, including babies, toddlers, and elderly. There is a terrible isolation that surrounds the lone black family in a hostile white neighborhood, pointed out Dorothy Newman, an expert on segregated housing in the 1970s. Even today, for African Americans to move into a town that hasn't had any African Americans for decades violates the norm. And sociologists know that norm violators usually get sanctioned. So blacks are right to be cautious. Families don't seek to be pioneers in civil rights. They simply want a nice place to live. Even absent any hostility from whites, there are logistical problems in moving to a sundown town. Where can we go to get our hair styled? Where will we go to church? Will we find friends? An African American who lives in Peoria suggested a major reason why black families don't desegregate the many sundown towns and suburbs around that city. Black kids raise a fit about being the only black kids in the high school. African Americans have a legacy of heroes who've gone before to inspire them. One I knew personally, Medgar Evers, selfless leader of the Mississippi Civil Rights Movement. Evers's vision of the America of the future didn't encompass allowing sundown suburbs to remain all white. In her memoir of him, his widow, Merle, makes this clear. One of Medgar's greatest pleasures during those summers in Chicago was the chance to explore the suburbs. Whenever he could, he'd borrow a car and drive out of the city to wander up one street and down another looking at houses. He had a dream of the sort of house he hoped someday to live in, the kind of street and neighborhood and town where he might raise a family. And the white suburbs of Chicago seemed to him right out of that dream. He'd spend whole days just driving slowly through the suburbs of Chicago's North Shore, looking at the beautiful houses and wishing. Years later, when we were in Chicago together, he took me on these drives and by that time he'd picked out specific houses that came closest to his dream. One of the suburbs Evers drove through four decades ago was Kenilworth. Although one black family did live there in the 1960s and 70s, today Kenilworth still awaits its pioneer. So do many others. Black efforts have changed sundown towns. In town after town, African Americans have braved appalling conditions, sometimes bringing along friends and family members for backup, usually persevering in the long run and winning the right to live in the former sundown town in peace. Sociologist George Henderson became the first black homeowner in Norman, Oklahoma, when he joined the faculty of the University of Oklahoma in 1967. In his memoirs, Henderson wrote, "Garbage was thrown on our lawn, a couple of car windows were broken, and we received obscene phone calls." In an interview with the student newspaper 35 years later, he recalled, "I feared for my family, but I was willing to die trying to make a difference. I had to come to terms with the fact I might be killed, but I believe that anything worth living for should be worth dying for." Henderson's fears weren't exaggerated, for residents of Norman had engaged in repeated acts of real or threatened violence toward African Americans over the years. Indeed, historian Bill Savage, who came to the University of Oklahoma the year before Henderson, was shown a big tree on a hill in Norman by a man who said his father took him there just 10 years earlier, in 1957 or 58, and pointed to a black man hanging from it, the last black man to violate the sundown rule in Norman. Sundown suburbs can be equally threatening. In 1957, William and Daisy Myers were the first African Americans to move into Levittown, Pennsylvania, built as a sundown suburb after World War II. They faced telephoned death threats, a mob milling across the street, and burning crosses on neighboring lawns. Daisy Myers, wife and mother of the family, kept a journal during the ordeal. She makes vivid the possible costs they anticipated. "We thought we should take the three children to York, Pennsylvania, to stay with their grandparents. But because Linda was so young, we decided to keep her with us. I felt that she'd be too much of a burden on Bill's family, with a formula to prepare and the other attention an infant requires. I remember saying to Bill that if we were killed in the house, Linda would be too young to know. At least, we'd have the boys to carry on." Despite the initial tension, usually the enterprise ends happily. A lawyer who left the black ghetto of San Francisco for a white neighborhood was struck that for the first time I was friendly with my immediate neighbors. They have the same interests we do. In his 1970 book about housing desegregation, James Hecht summarized, "When a Negro family moves into a white area, there are problems which few whites appreciate. But these problems usually are far less than the blacks anticipated." He traced records of some 500 black families who'd moved into previously all-white neighborhoods in the Buffalo, New York area since 1964. "None are known to have moved back to the ghetto," he reported. About 50 of these families, including most of those who experienced unpleasant incidents, were interviewed in some depth. All were glad they'd made the move. All would do it again. Hecht was able to generalize these results beyond Buffalo. Most of the families who moved found something else they hadn't anticipated, a warm welcome by some of their new neighbors. Fair housing groups throughout the nation report that black families moving into white neighborhoods usually had more friendly calls of welcome than did white families who moved into the same neighborhoods. The GOTRO program in Chicago likewise proves that whites do accept African-American neighbors, even low-income ones. Victor Ward started the process of change in Cherokee, Oklahoma, during the summer of 1977. A young petroleum engineer, newly minted by Marietta College in Ohio, Ward landed a job with Conoco, and they assigned him to Cherokee. I arrived at the beginning of the summer and started to look for a place to live. I started with my work associates and then asked around, and they sent me from one person to the next, and I got, "No, that's not available," and "Sorry, that's been rented." Ward ended up in a shack, really, at the edge of town, didn't even have electricity. Then he got a breakthrough. A woman who'd earlier turned him down phoned him at the Conoco office. She said she'd talked with her pastor about it. Ward repeated her words to him. "I'm thinking if I'd sent my son to some other town, I'd hope they wouldn't treat him the way the people of Cherokee have treated you." So she rented to Ward, who became the first African-American to live in previously sundown Cherokee, at least the first in decades. His co-workers socialized with him after work and invited him to their homes, and he had a fine summer. That he came in under the aegis of Conoco surely helped, but so did Ward's positive outlook. "I think at the end of the day, I kind of won the town." The census showed Cherokee with no African Americans in 1950, 1960, and 1970, but five in 1980 after Ward's breakthrough. Cherokee may need another Ward, however, because in 1990 it was back to its former all-white status, and in 2000 it had but two African Americans and no black households. Often blacks do win the town. Henderson is now a treasured senior member of the faculty and community in Norman. Although it took decades, Levittown now honors the Myerses. In December 1999, Bristol Township Mayor Sam Fenton invited Daisy Myers to Levittown. Her husband had died in 1987. And offered her a public apology. Levittown named a blue spruce tree in front of the municipal building Miss Daisy and uses it as the township Christmas tree. There can be no doubt that white residents now fully accept the right of African Americans to live in both Norman and Levittown. Sometimes it takes two attempts. After the first families forced out from a town, the racists who rebuffed them may be surprised to receive mixed messages, even condemnation from other residents, so they don't mount another attack when another family tries a year or so later. Passing a Residents' Rights Act. All the solutions suggested thus far may not suffice to remedy the tougher cases, whether these turn out to be independent towns like Anna or elite suburbs like Kenilworth. Indeed, the remedies America has tried thus far are reminiscent of the freedom of choice phase of school desegregation, 1955 through 1969. Just as policies in that discredited era placed the burden of desegregating our nation's schools on individual black children, so our attempts at desegregating our nation's neighborhoods have placed the burden on individual black families. But our nation has a national interest in desegregating white communities. What's needed is a law, a Residents' Rights Act, that makes it in an entire town's interest to welcome African Americans. This proposed remedy embodies the conclusion reached by Zane Miller, who wrote a history of Forest Park, Ohio, established as a sundown suburb of Cincinnati in the 1950s. He noted that African Americans first began to move into Forest Park during 1967, and by 1970, 470 lived in larger Forest Park. This was more than enough to make Forest Park a frontline suburb. And by 2000, its population was 56% black. Miller understood the key role played by Cincinnati's all-white suburbs in Forest Park's transformation and realized that the only way to achieve stable racial desegregation in metropolitan areas is by attacking sundown suburbs. What Forest Park needed was a national and metropolitan policy which would open up the wedges of overwhelmingly white suburbs on the metropolitan area's western and eastern flanks. Until that happened, the pattern of metropolitan ghettoization within scattered political jurisdictions would persist. Sociologist Herbert Gans, who studied New Jersey's Levittown, now called Willingboro, came up with a similar recommendation. If all communities must integrate, no one can expect to live in all white communities. So did William Levitt himself, whose company built more sundown suburbs than any other. Levitt knew that sundown suburbs were bad for America. Nevertheless, he continued to build them. Only when all builders are forced to sell on a fair basis, he reasoned, would any of them be able to afford an end to discrimination, according to housing expert Dorothy Newman. Otherwise, if Levitt didn't keep African Americans out, he'd be the only developer that didn't, so all the blacks would flood into his towns. When members of CORE demonstrated at his sundown development in Bel Air, Maryland, Levitt called on President John F. Kennedy to put some real teeth into his ineffectual order opposing discrimination in housing, to force all suburbs to end discrimination. Kennedy didn't respond, and Levitt took no steps on his own to desegregate the communities he built. Ironically, the evolution of Levitt's development in New Jersey shows that Levitt had a point. The three Levitt towns developed very differently. The first black family moved into Levittown, Pennsylvania in 1957. The town wasn't very welcoming, and by 2000 was still only 2.4% black. Not a single one of the Long Island Levitt Town's 82,000 residents was black in 1960, according to Kenneth Jackson, and by 2000, only 266 were, just 0.5% of the 53,067 residents, a clear reflection of its racist heritage. The third Levitt Town, now Willingboro, New Jersey, had a very different history. In 1958, William Levitt announced that he would not sell any of its homes to African Americans. New Jersey's governor ordered an investigation. U.S. Senator Clifford Case requested that the FHA refuse to insure mortgages in Levittown, and two African Americans who were turned away from the development sued Levitt in state court. Levitt took the case to the New Jersey Supreme Court, claiming his houses were a private matter. But the court held that the involvement of the FHA and other agencies made them publicly assisted, and Leavitt was forced to desegregate Willingboro. Eventually, agents began to steer African Americans toward Willingboro, which by 1980 was 38% black. Willingboro residents struggled to stay interracial in the midst of overwhelmingly white competitors. One step was to ban for sale signs to slow white flight. But the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the ban, finding that the town failed to establish that it was necessary to maintain integration. In 2000, Willingboro does remain integrated, being 61% black. But some commentators dismiss it as black or 80% black, which may be a self-fulfilling description. Thus, Willingboro may wind up proving Leavitt's and Gantz's and Miller's larger contention that it's hard for one suburb to stay interracial while others stay all white. Willingboro also shows that government action, in this case by a governor, senator, and court, is the surest way to cause change. To be effective, a law must be written to preclude a town from merely claiming that it welcomes all newcomers without regard to race. After all, since 1968, towns don't admit they're all white on purpose. Realtors don't admit they steer. Bankers don't admit they redline. Police deny racial profiling. And in many places, neighbors deny they threaten or shun. Proving that officials of a town or suburb keep out African-American residents today can thus be difficult. Just as in the early 1960s, no Southern registrar would admit that would-be voters had to be white to register, even though their majority black county might have thousands of white and only a handful of black registered voters. Therefore, I suggest a Residents' Rights Act, parallel to the Registration Clause of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, extended and strengthened in 1982. This law provides that in counties with an unusual disparity between the percentage of the black and white electorates registered to vote, the Department of Justice can send in federal examiners once complaints have been received from 10 individuals who were rebuffed when trying to register. Similarly, a blatant disparity between the percentage of a town's population that's African American compared to the proportion in the metropolitan area, the entire state for independent sundown towns, will trigger sanctions under the Residents' Rights Act when coupled with at least two valid complaints from families who were rebuffed when trying to buy or rent a home in the community and a careful showing that it was a sundown town. Proving that a community was a sundown town is doable if it was one, even if gathering candid admissions of continuing discriminatory behavior in the present is not. Because sundown policies are typically self-maintaining, it's appropriate to shift the burden to the community to show that it has changed them. The Residents' Rights Act in operation. Congress or a state could pass a Residents' Rights Act. If Congress acted, the required complaints would go to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which would have the power to hear complaints of recent discrimination and collect evidence on whether the town has a sundown past. The first consequence for towns that trigger the Residents' Rights Act will be federal housing examiners, parallel to the elections examiners of the Voting Rights Act. These examiners will investigate complaints, provide community relations services to the town, and meet with town officials, real estate agents, schools, and representatives of churches and other organizations to try to create an atmosphere more hospitable to African Americans or others claiming to have been excluded. The examiners can require local officials to proclaim that their town is open to all, set up a human relations commission, and order all real estate agents licensed to sell property in the town to state their intent to show, rent, and sell property without regard to race. The examiners will also be empowered to sit in on meetings between agents and African-American would-be renters or purchasers. Real estate agents may not be the problem, or at least not the whole problem. So housing examiners may not lead to real progress. In that event, the examiners will have the power to penalize the town. What sanctions are appropriate? Everyone from city officials to bankers to police to nearby neighbors may play a role in making it hard for African Americans to move to sundown towns and suburbs. So, sanctions must make it in all these actors' interests to open up. The Clean Air Act offers a useful parallel. Under its provisions, if a city's air quality falls below a certain minimum, no more tax dollars can be spent on highways and development until it cleans up its air. Similarly, under the Residents' Rights Act, no more tax dollars can be spent on discretionary programs in a sundown town or suburb until it cleans up its segregation. Tax money that assists innocent people, such as for disaster relief, aid to disabled children, and the like, will still flow. Ongoing expenditures will not be affected. But the town will be shut out from seeking new funds for sewage facilities, police training, and 1,001 other programs. After all, every dollar of federal or state tax money spent in a sundown community is a dollar spent only on white Americans, yet collected from all Americans. There are precedents for this. In 1947, under the auspices of the American Heritage Foundation, the United States government and America's railroads sent a freedom train around the country, carrying original copies of the Declaration of Independence and other important documents. This joint public-private venture proved very successful, drawing some 3,500,000 visitors in 322 cities. Columnist Drew Pearson helped instigate the effort. When Pearson learned that the train was scheduled to stop at Glendale, California, knowing that Glendale was a sundown town, on his national radio broadcast, he stated that the train would not stop in Glendale because Negroes could not stay there after dark, according to Bob Johnson, who remembers the broadcast. The train also bypassed Birmingham, Alabama, after city officials there refused to let African Americans visit it except during hours specifically set aside for them. Langston Hughes wrote a poem about the Freedom Train, including the line, "Everybody's got a right to board the Freedom Train." In its refusal to visit segregated Birmingham and sundown Glendale, the Freedom Train indeed lived up to its name. The chief federal judge for Southern Illinois wants to deny Benton federal tax dollars today because it's a sundown town. His district, the Southern District of Illinois, epitomizes the sundown problem in America. The United States District Court holds court in two cities there, East St. Louis, 97.7% black, and Benton, 99.5% white. Judge G. Patrick Murphy is trying to keep a new $70 million federal courthouse from being built in Benton. I think it's fundamentally wrong to send the resources of the federal government, particularly in regard to the court system, to a community that's not diverse and is not enthusiastic about letting our employees participate fully in community life, said Murphy in October 2002. The mayor of Benton, Patricia Bauer, made her position clear. We're a very small community, and I don't apologize for Benton's racial makeup. Murphy isn't the only official concerned about sundown towns. An attorney in Monticello, Illinois, said that his central Illinois sundown town had similar trouble getting federal funding for a county courthouse project because they had no non-white workers. In 1982, a class action lawsuit filed on behalf of African Americans alleged widespread deliberate housing discrimination throughout East Texas. In response to the complaint, U.S. District Court Judge William Wayne Justice ordered desegregation of public housing in towns throughout East Texas. Several, including Vidor and Alba, were sundown towns, so of course their public housing projects were all white. Every public expenditure in those towns was reserved for whites. In 1992, Vidor gained national notoriety when several black households moved into a public housing project, became the town's first African-American residents, and were all driven out by Ku Klux Klan demonstrations, racial slurs, and threats. Making sundown towns ineligible for federal or state funds may not suffice, especially in affluent communities. Some school districts and institutions of higher education similarly turned their back on funds for education, loans for dormitories, and the like, choosing to stay segregated. If needed, a simpler sanction will come into play, making use of the income tax code. Denial of the federal home mortgage interest deduction. This deduction has long been one of the important ways our tax code favors middle and higher income Americans, allowing homeowners to deduct the largest single component of their housing outlay, while renters get no such break. The rationale for this deduction is our national interest in encouraging homeownership. Surely America has no national interest in encouraging homeownership in sundown towns, however. So it should grant no exemption for mortgage interest payments by homeowners who choose to live in such communities. Denial of the mortgage interest exemption has additional benefits that should make it attractive to lawmakers. It costs nothing and commits the federal government to no massive new program of housing construction. On the contrary, it brings in revenue. Second, we've seen that because all white suburbs have more prestige, typically they enjoy higher housing values. Removal of the interest exemption will make such property less valuable, offsetting this gain from sundown policies. Third, it allows for local control. A sundown town or suburb can opt to stay all white. Alternatively, it can desegregate in any way it wants, from developing low-cost housing to recruiting African-American families to buy existing homes. Best of all, eliminating the mortgage interest exemption avoids problematizing the poor black family, for whom perpetual government assistance seems required. Instead, the Residents' Rights Act recognizes segregated white communities as the problem and makes it in their residents' interest to stop their problematic behavior. Indeed, all a town has to do to end or avoid these sanctions is to publicize that it's now open to all, take steps suggested by federal housing examiners, and admit a few African-American residents. As soon as its population no longer displays the blatant racial disparity that triggered suspicion in the first place, it'll be off the list. For example, Grosse Pointe will need to become about 2.3% black, 1.5% higher than its 2000 proportion, 0.8%. Since it had 5,670 people in 2000, this requires it to welcome 85 more African Americans. An easy task, since neighboring Detroit has 775,000 African Americans and is more than 82% black. Independent sundown towns such as Arcola might find it harder. Arcola would need about 38 more African Americans to reach 1.54% black, one-tenth as black as Illinois statewide. It could and should recruit them, perhaps from larger nearby towns such as Decatur and Champaign. After all, it now draws white flight from those towns. If it finds this problematic, then after recruiting two or three families, thus moving beyond the sundown town threshold, it could ask the examiners to be removed from the sanction list, so long as they concur that the town has ended its discriminatory practices. The Residents' Rights Act requires not integration, but an end to exclusion. It merely uses demography as evidence that exclusion has ceased. Recovering sundown towns can submit other evidence showing they've ended their restrictive policies and thus avoid any penalty. At present, instead of penalizing sundown towns, governments reward them. For the last quarter of the 20th century, sundown towns in southern Illinois, for example, got more than their fair share of federal expenditures. During that era, Kenneth Gray, representative in Congress for the region, earned the nickname Prince of Pork for all the federal money he brought to his hometown, West Frankfort, all white since it drove out its African Americans in 1920, and to nearby sundown towns. Independent sundown towns often languish economically. Their leaders don't seek new ideas or new companies, so employment plummets. Instead of withdrawing state and federal aid from these towns, governments award them prisons and juvenile detention centers to give their economies a boost. To penologists, places such as Chehalis, Washington, Clarinda, Iowa, Izard County, Arkansas, Pollock, Louisiana, Brown County, Dwight, Pinckneyville, Vandalia, Vienna, and other locations in Illinois, Perry County, Indiana, Wayne County, and various other white valleys in Pennsylvania, the Adirondack counties of New York, Garrett County, Maryland, and other places with overwhelmingly white populations seem to be ideal. In a circular process, prisons then put more people into sparsely settled, overwhelmingly white districts, people who can't vote, magnifying the clout of their representatives in state legislatures. Governments also often honor sundown towns. At their city limits, sometimes right where the infamous sundown signs used to be, now stand congratulatory signs toasting the towns with such designations as Governor's Hometown Award, Illinois Main Street Community, Illinois Certified City, Michigan Educational Excellence Award, U.S. Department of Education Exemplary School, and the like. Surely no sundown town deserves these awards. The Illinois Main Street program, for example, run by the Lieutenant Governor's office, has to do mostly with revitalizing downtowns. Among its guidelines are demonstrate broad-based private and public sector support for downtown revitalization, and develop vision and mission statements. Surely, broad-based support should include support from people other than whites. Surely a town should have a vision of itself as a multiracial community moved beyond its petty prejudices. Surely main streets that a state recognizes as exemplary should be streets that people of color can feel comfortable strolling down. Owosso, Michigan, won the 2000 Michigan Educational Excellence Award. But Owosso High School can't help but impart racism, along with chemistry, algebra, and its other subjects, owing to its historically intentional racial makeup. Mariemont, Ohio, boasts a plaque saying, U.S. Department of Education Exemplary School. But an all-white school can hardly be exemplary. Surely citizens should demand that civic and educational competitions like these establish standards of racial tolerance that communities must meet before they can receive these awards. Integrated neighborhoods and towns are possible. The Residents' Rights Act would have aided integration in Southfield, Michigan, which, according to Detroit Divided, had the distinction of being the only prosperous Detroit suburb with a large and growing black population, 29% in 1990. Precisely because it had this distinction, by 2000, Southfield was 56% black. In the absence of policies that would open up overwhelmingly white suburbs, towns such as Southfield are likely to become overwhelmingly non-white. The recent past offers hope for an end to racial exclusion, however. The previous chapter showed that at least half of our sundown towns and suburbs have probably given way. Surely we can desegregate the last half. Some tough towns have cracked. Residents of Valley Stream on Long Island intimidated realtors and black clients in the 1980s. Nevertheless, by 1990, it had 149 African Americans among its 33,946 residents. And in 2000, 2,714 African Americans called Valley Stream home. Even Martinsville, Indiana, whose sundown notoriety was confirmed by new episodes of hateful behavior in the 1990s, may have given in. The 2000 census showed two African American households, and reports indicate that one or two other families have since moved in. Entire suburbs have resisted tipping point theory, which predicts that once African Americans reach a certain proportion, often said to be 15%, whites will flee. Park Forest, Illinois, shows how its leaders made a conscious decision to stop being a sundown town in 1961. Ted Hippel, who lived in Park Forest at the time, described the process. Blacks were moving from Chicago to the suburbs, and some looked at housing in Park Forest. Leo Jacobson and others in the government, to avoid any possible clustering of the black families and any resulting blockbusting consequences, were instrumental in allocating them to various parts of town, well separated from each other, with prior notification of the neighbors that a black family would be moving in. As of 2000, Park Forest was still stably integrated, with 9,247 African Americans in a total population of 23,462. Another Chicago suburb, Oak Park, employed a similar strategy. In the early 1970s, Oak Park began to experience substantial black in-migration, according to Carol Goodwin, who wrote The Oak Park Strategy, about its methods for staying interracial. Oak Park garnered national renown as an integrated suburb after giving up its sundown status. In 1977, Goodwin wrote, Oak Park could not confidently be called a racially stable, integrated community. But by 2000, Oak Park could be, having 11,788 African-American residents among more than 52,000 total population, about 22%. White demand for houses continues to be strong. Oak Park led all suburban zip codes in housing appreciation over the period 1998 through 2003. In the last 20 years, whites have sometimes moved into majority black neighborhoods. When this happens, liberals often cry gentrification, but the resulting class and racial mix usually lasts for many years, to the betterment of municipal services and the city's tax base. Tipping point theory can't explain gentrification, nor can it explain Mount Rainier, Maryland, a working-class suburb of Washington, D.C. that was 56% black in 1990, 62% in 2000, and probably 59% in 2005. The experiment of living together, said one white newcomer in 2003, as opposed to being polarized as black or white or Latino, makes those labels break down and leaves a whole lot more room for finding common ground. Once a town eases its restrictive policies, all kinds of interesting people may move in. Among the families that seek to live in multiracial towns are multiracial families. Devera Cohn visited meetings of the Interracial Family Circle, a Washington, D.C. area group, in 2002. The pros and cons of different neighborhoods are constant topics of conversation, she wrote. She quoted the group's president, Nancy Lee Knox. People want to be where it's diverse. Everyone talks about it as being the primary criterion. Knox and her husband are white, but have two black adopted sons. We want our children to live where there are lots of different kinds of people, Knox said. It turns out lots of people are like Knox, and not just members of interracial families. A librarian in Decatur, my central Illinois hometown, spoke with pride of his interracial neighborhood in the West End, which had been a sundown neighborhood when I grew up in it. And there's a gay couple on the block, and no one thinks anything about it. Because of whites who want to live in tolerant places, towns such as Mount Rainier and Oak Park and interracial neighborhoods within cities not only survive, but develop cachet. Other towns and neighborhoods may not be as well known for being integrated, especially those that are working and lower middle class, but they endure, decade after decade, providing African Americans and European Americans and Asian Americans, Hispanics, and Native Americans with unheralded places to live that are stably 10 to 80% black. The goal's worth pursuing. Partly because living in an integrated environment causes each racial group to define we non-racially. Interracial contact itself thus usually becomes a humanizing process. Here's an example from Baltimore back in about 1947. In the words of a white housewife, 37 years old, the mother of three children, "When a colored family moved next door to us, I was horrified. I just couldn't see why they wanted to live where white people lived. I wanted my husband to move right away. We've lived here for 15 years, and we own our own home. I would never let our children play with the children next door, or even talk with them. But in spite of all I told them about colored people, they still talked with them. One day my youngest boy came in the house with a ball that he said the little colored boy next door had given him. I was mad and made him give it back. My child was hurt, and it seemed that I was both cruel and unfair to him. After several weeks, it suddenly occurred to me that those people weren't bothering me at all. They were polite and always spoke to us. Their children were, well, just children. My husband and Mr. W. soon began to talk to each other over the back fence, and Mrs. W. and I also began to exchange greetings. The children run back and forth to both houses. We do favors for each other, just as other neighbors do. They're no different now from any of my other neighbors." That's only one woman's opinion, of course, but other researchers made a systematic comparison of the attitudes of white residents of two integrated public housing projects and two white-only projects. Attitudes in the integrated projects were much more favorable toward people of different races. In suburbs like Oak Park and Mount Rainier, whose residents made a decision to stay integrated, white residents have perforce made black friends. As Emily Barnett of Shaker Heights, Ohio, put it, "Because there was a need to do this, we came to know people intimately. It was the only way we could get past race." Desegregating independent sundown towns benefits their residents, especially their children, by lessening their unease about the interracial outside world, thus expanding their options for college, vacations, and places to live and work. Children in elite sundown suburbs already have lots of options, but desegregation can likewise help them decrease their stereotypes about other races and be more comfortable in interracial milieu. Research by Orfield shows that most students in desegregated schools hold positive views about their experience. More than 90% of a sample of high school juniors in Louisville, Kentucky, for example, say they're comfortable working with students of another race. Whites and blacks also feel they can discuss racial issues across racial lines. Adults benefit, too. In her Philadelphia area research, Carolyn Adams found that the most liberal racial attitudes were observed among whites living in neighborhoods that were racially integrated, defined as those in which at least 5% of the local population was black. Merely encountering African Americans as neighbors, PTA members, and so on, can improve white rhetoric, because social and political discussions are impoverished by the absence of African Americans. We've seen that sundown towns both collect and create racists, while integrated towns both collect and create anti-racists. Just as cognitive dissonance makes whites more racist when they live in a sundown town, which they must justify, so it makes whites less racist, even anti-racist, when they live in a multiracial town, which they must justify. Ideology and attitudes thus flow from one social structure with profound consequences for the next generation. For readers wanting a personal rationale for living an integrated lifestyle, This is one. Moving toward an integrated America. America should not have white neighborhoods or black neighborhoods. It should have just neighborhoods. People who live in interracial neighborhoods and towns have taken an important stand in favor of better race relations. Integration is no panacea, but there's no substitute. There seems to be no stable resting point between slavery, which, though stable in a way, required constant vigilance, and fully equal democracy. Since we haven't yet attained fully equal democracy, race relations remains unstable, fluid, a source of continuing contention in our society. In this situation, those who act for racial justice are also helping to build social stability, maybe even the beloved community yearned for in the civil rights movement. Integrated towns and suburbs are a necessary first step to integrated hearts and minds. Until we solve the problem of sundown neighborhoods and towns, we don't have a chance of solving America's race problem. It all seems to be taking a very long time. As the last chapter noted, "Ain't No Niggers Allowed Anna," the town with which this book began, still may not allow African Americans to live within its city limits. Surely its continued existence as a sundown town, and that of all the other sundown towns and suburbs that still haven't changed, tells us it's taking far too long. The remedies suggested here, especially the Residents' Rights Act, remove the all-important badge of governmental approval, or at least government neutrality, from sundown towns and suburbs. In Black and White, their 1972 hit song about school integration, the rock group Three Dog Night showed that they understood the importance of government action. After the federal government finally enforced school desegregation in the South, they sang, "Now a child can understand, this is the law of all the land, all the land." But was it? School desegregation was the law only in the South. In the North, after Millikan, sundown suburbs maintained school segregation by excluding African Americans from their neighborhoods. So now the child remains confused. Blacks passing through may be abused. What is the law of all the land? Do sundown policies still stand? Or might we yet, as Three Dog Night put it, learn together to read and write? Then indeed, as they go on to sing, the whole world looks upon the sight, a beautiful sight.
The End. You've been listening to Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of Segregation in America, by James W. Loewen. Narrated by Norman Dietz and directed by Jenny Selig. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
We just wrapped up this book with lyrics from some white rock group in the 1970s. Wow. That sidetracked me. Just getting to that, I didn't think that was going to be the summation for everything that we've covered in this text, all of the terrorism and what have you. That's how we wrap things up. Anyway, beyond that, I do think it is significant, hopefully a constructive investment of time and energy for those who have invested, either listening live, listening to the archives, whatever it is, in getting through James Loewen Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. That is important as well. They did not, if you heard that, they didn't just say A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. They said A Hidden Dimension of Segregation in America. That is a substantial change to the title of the text of the book. That's what sometimes you can catch just little things that are really significant. I know President Obama's autobiography, Dreams from My Father, we read that. There were significant changes from the written text to the audiobook as well. But anyway, we have had our book club here for 7 years. I just think Dr. Welsing said consistently, reading is more important than watching television. We have invested an extraordinary amount of time reading texts that focused on racism, white supremacy, mostly. We've had some others in there that did not necessarily focus on racism specifically, 1984, Getting Things Done, a few others. But even those reveal a lot still about racism, white supremacy. I hope folks have gathered a lot from the books. Hopefully we'll pick something entertaining and informative for our new book starting next week. But wow, we have covered a lot of books over the years. You can go back through the archives and just pick at will. It is amazing. Medical Apartheid is in there. 2000 Seasons, the autobiography of Malcolm X, Assata Shakur, Wretched of the Earth, formerly the worst book I ever read, The Hate U Give. I mean, we've read lots. I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. It is impressive. Like, I do not read it frequently, but the times that I have read the entire catalog of texts that we've covered in our book club, every time I read it, I become even more impressed. Like, wow, even if you read a half of the books on that list, I think you would learn a lot about racism, white supremacy. That's it. We are all done. Sundown Towns, if you have comments, questions you would like to share, concluding thoughts about the book, the number 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. There is no more audio. Book is done, so we do not have a second audio segment. We'll share, give our concluding thoughts, and that will do it for this week. But no second audio segment, so concluding thoughts, final analysis of what we heard from Mr. Lowen. The number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see, folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have any final thoughts. This, I will say, as I'm struggling to get the switchboard here, I will say I did not necessarily enjoy the concluding part of the book, kind of last week, this week. I didn't think that was as enjoyable. Didn't have quite the same amount of constructive information as some of the earlier portions of the text. Even with that, I thought there were some extraordinarily important points, and some of you had to wait till the very end to get to. But even with that, I do think generally, if I start reading a book, I really try to finish it, even if it's a book that I don't like. That's why we have not. I don't think there's ever been a book that we just quit reading on the book club. We have persevered and pushed through all the way to the end. I forgot somebody was talking about the book that we read, The Killer. I can pull it up on my library, but he was in the war. He was killed. American Sniper. That's it. American Sniper, Chris Kyle. Pushed through even that one all the way to the end, because then I can give a complete analysis, and you'd be surprised. You can learn a lot. Sometimes it'll be the last chapter that has the jewel that you were supposed to find in the book. With that, let's see. Folks with comment, hand, gripe that they would like to share, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter in Florida.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everyone. one thing about not only this book, but what I hear from white people, especially when they are giving quote unquote answers to solving the problem of racism and white supremacy. They, other than a whole lot of, what was the recording you used to always play of justice? You just using you when you
buckets,
when you're saying that
buckets.
You just say buckets and buckets of words. Yeah, other than buckets and buckets of words, they actually have the nerve to place non-white black people in the midst of all of the danger is not the word, but the midst of the risk to death, I mean death risk that the black people have to do. In other words, basically he is stating things that have already gone down in history. In other words, the Little Rock Nine. Here you had instead of white people solving the problem of racism, white supremacy, nine black children went and risked their lives every day for something that still is a problem today. The school system in this part of the world. I can mention a list of things. Voting, black people risking their lives, getting killed, and who is the president of this part of the world right now? I can go on and on as far as that concern. I hope I'm getting some understanding on what I'm illustrating. And this is quite typical of white people. Am I correct by stating this, that this is what this person was suggesting?
I did hear a few portions in the text where he was talking about black people risking life, limb, their children, family members, life, limb, in the goal of ending these sundown, all-white, so-called segregated residential areas, and that many of the folks who made this risk, many of the black people, victims who made this risk, saying that they thought it was worth it. I did hear quite a bit of that in this final portion today.
Right, and I didn't bring it up. He brought up Mega Evers, who was shot to death in his garage, getting out of his car. Before that, his life was constantly, and his family, life was constantly in danger, where his wife and himself would routinely go through a practice with the children when they hear gunshots to get down. I mean, his life was like under siege every day. You know, and this is typical of white people making these type of suggestions, whereas Mr. Fuller stating logically years ago, you know, with the situation where, let's say, with John Brown, even with which is the only white person that they can come up with. But yet he also put black lives in danger also with the idea of now. If that's an initiative that's based on ourselves, then fine and good. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about from the standpoint of white people making the suggestion on what we should do in risking our lives, and they have the power to end this problem within about 72 hours. That's just my report on this book. It came all the way down to this, what he had to say in his last reading. You know, I mean, come on. I mean, I sure would like for him to be on your program. I think you've been trying to get him on, but there are some questions that he needs to be asked and as far as to get some answers to some questions involving his report on what is the answer or the solution to the problem, which I think white people ultimately should be challenged with and be responsible for. But I know that it eventually it's going to take non-white people who are most impacted by this terror to come up with the answer to the problem, because white people are not going to do that. They're not even interested. And that's all I have to say. Well, one more thing I have to say right now. Is it still time to make a book suggestion?
I reckon.
I brought up, I think a few days ago, Sam Cooke and Paul Robeson, but mainly Paul Robeson. Just wanted to give you a, and I got a suggestion from a friend of mine who has been reading Paul Robeson for years. And this is the list of the people that he had a direct influence on. Nelson Mandela, Kwame Nkrumah, Julius Nyerere, Sekou Touré, Leopold Senghor, Jomo Kenyatta, Malcolm X, Nehru. These are some of the people that he had a direct effect on as far as his understandings of the global system of racism, white supremacy, and its suggestions on how to neutralize that problem. That's mainly why. I mean, there's some other things about Paul Robeson that most of us know about. He was an actor. That too. That I didn't know, but he was an actor, football player, lawyer. I think he was the first black athlete that was quote unquote all American, that sort of thing. But mainly from the standpoint, this book I know because I know the person who gave me the suggestion of the book. Doesn't have anything about those type of accolades as an athlete and all of that. It's basically talking about his influence through his articulation of how to solve the problem of racism, white supremacy to these people that we, most of us know about. And that's the reason why the suggestion came up. And that's it. Thank you.
You're just saying just buckets and buckets of words.
Right on. Much obliged, retired firefighter. Mr. Beach, when he was on the program, mentioned Mr. Robeson and some of his literature. I think he mentioned a book specifically.
Oh, I didn't get a name of the book. I did all that talking. Let me give you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I gave you the name of the book?
Oh, no. Go ahead.
The name of the book is Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary. And it's orange, and it has a drawing of him in the middle of Paul Robeson. The caption Paul Robeson is at the top, and just below his image is the artist as revolutionary. I think there's a reading to it, automatic reading to it also. I could be wrong about that, but I think it is.
That would be lovely. Save Gus and someone else, their vocals. The artist as revolutionary.
Right on.
Awesome. Much obliged, retired firefighter. Thank you for the book suggestion and commentary on the text, Mr. Lowen, what he had to say. I think that is pretty consistent with the recommendations that suspected racists offer to victims about how to go about solving this problem, and Medgar Evers. I guess other people, if folks have thoughts on that, his inclusion, it almost seemed like, because he mentioned Medgar Evers' wife by her first name, Merle, and I know sometimes in writing that's standard. It can be if you're mentioning people in the same family, even if they're married, they have the same last name, where you wouldn't repeat the last name. Like sometimes if people are talking about Venus and Serena Williams, you would not say Venus Williams and Serena Williams generally if you were going to be talking about them in the same sentence. or if it was going to be in consecutive sentences. That is standard in professional writing according to general style rules. I've practiced it myself, but I did feel some type of way because Medgar Evers, assassinated victim of white supremacy, shot down in front of his wife and children, in fact, in front of their residence, 1963. And he mentioned them like they were homies. Like, I wouldn't care if he met him or whatever. Like, okay, you lived in Mississippi. Like, were you a victim of terrorism? Like, you've done all this work. You talked about white people. I mean, something just, it bothered me. Him mentioning her on a first name basis and not talking about all the terrorism he faced in Mississippi, but just to present him as he had these dreams of living in the suburbs in Chicago. Like, yeah. If any folks, any other listeners have thoughts about that presentation of Medgar Evers, feel free. That's another reason why I do think it's constructive, because that in and of itself could be a mental exercise to just think about that. Like, yeah, anyway, if other folks, if you have thoughts about his use of Medgar Evers in the text and or your own thoughts or questions as we conclude Sundown Towns, *61, line should be open. Proceed. Perhaps other folks are taking a few moments to get their notes together. I will share some of the notes that I have taken. I will reach out to Mr. Lowen to see if we can have him on the broadcast again. It seemed that he might be aware that we're reading his book. He may have left a comment, someone attempting to look and post as though they were him, wrote and said that we were doing great work reading his book. So he might be aware that we're doing his book on the book club. You can reach out and say we finished cover to cover and, you know, have some questions. Come hang out for a spell and answer a few questions about that Medgar Evers. Let's see, some of the notes that I took on the last portion here. I think, as I already said, I didn't enjoy this week and or last week very much. The last two sessions were not as constructive. Lots of use of race relations and just white people giving out nonsense. White people could, I think he said it last week, white people could solve this problem. Just regular average white people, not the president, not the governor, regular average whites could solve this problem. They don't want to. And I just keep going back. Melissa Harris Perry, this is not some wild militant publication. Melissa Harris Perry on MSNBC. I have the sound clip. I just have to go back in so I can dig through and find it. But she did a segment on her program where an Emory professor, black female, had done the research. She showed white people do not want to live around black people, period. And this is not like a sliver, a small number, a few hillbillies out in the Appalachian. No, 75% of white people do not want to live with black people, period. Doesn't matter how much money they have. Doesn't matter if it's no crime. Doesn't matter if it's great schools. All of that is irrelevant. Are there niggers there? No thanks. 75%. And that's probably what they call conservative estimate. And even still, that's not the point. The point is we're in a system of white supremacy racism, regardless of whether there are 50 niggers in your neighborhood or zero. Not talking about things in that framework is one of the major ways that white people practice racism, white supremacy, because that's, and I have it in the description every time for every single episode, I think 17 of them for this book club. Mr. Lowen and many other white people, they will use the term racism, and I put it in quotes. That does not mean that it has been correctly defined or that they're giving proper context for that term, which makes them even more dangerous. That is a major art of deception, to use a word where the word has less meaning. Now, you can just use it any old kind of way, and whites are extraordinary with doing that, especially with terms like racism. Anyway, specifically to this week, okay, all of these suggestions, passing a Residence Rights Act and these forms of legislation, it would have to be white people that passed this legislation to make these sort of things happen. That is not going to happen. Donald Trump in the White House, is this sort of legislation going to pass? Is there going to be some sort of federal backing to make sure that Negro homeowners, renters have quality access and are not being denied access to certain towns or neighborhoods or being steered away from certain houses? The Trump administration, they're going to support that. Even the Obama administration, they're going to support that. Back up even further, the Bush administration, they're going to support that. Really? Bernie Sanders even said he didn't support reparations. He's going to support that? Really? Next. He said, often blacks do win the town is in quotes. Henderson is now treasured senior member of the faculty and community in Norman. Although it took decades, Levittown now honors the Myerses. In December 1999, Bristol Township Mayor Sam Fenton invited Daisy Myers to Levittown. Her husband died in 1987 and offered her a public apology. Levittown named a blue spruce tree in front of the municipal building Miss Daisy and uses it as a township Christmas tree. Something about that just struck me as really tacky, to name a tree after a black person you terrorized, you bring her back years later to say, we're sorry, and here's a tree that we'll decorate on White Jesus's birthday once a year in your honor. Are you serious? Are you serious? My husband died in 1987, probably because of some of the stress that we encountered living with you all, and this is the best you can do. A spruce tree named after me. Wow. Let's see. There can be no doubt that white residents now fully accept the right of African Americans to live in both Norman and Levittown. We're still in a system of racism, white supremacy. Just keep coming back. That is the most important thing. And that is a statement that's not really qualified. I wouldn't care how many black people are there. I don't see an exact number, but it wouldn't matter. I would be very curious to know what they say when there are no black people around. The grandcestor. Continuing. Next. Make sure I get the full sentence here. For the last quarter of the 20th century, sundown towns in southern Illinois, for example, got more than their share of federal expenditures. Oh, I thought this was so important. One of the most important portions in the text. I'm going to start this over. For the last quarter of the 20th century, sundown towns in southern Illinois, for example, got more than their share. In fact, I'm going to back up to read the previous sentence because that is all important. At present, instead of penalizing sundown towns, there was a page flip. That's why I didn't start late. And instead of penalizing sundown towns, governments reward them. For the last quarter of the 20th century, sundown towns in southern Illinois, for example, got more than their share of federal expenditures. During that era, Kenneth Gray, representative in Congress for the region, earned the nickname Prince of Pork for all the federal money he brought to his hometown, West Frankfort, all white since it drove out its African Americans in 1920 and to nearby sundown towns. I'll pause there. That is important. That would seem to suggest rewards for practicing racism, white supremacy. There are no Negroes here. And NPR confirms they had a report within the last 6 months talking about social services programs generally have much better resources and are much less punitive. Like if you forget, you know, to cross a T on page 29 of the form, then you immediately lose all of your benefits. Like they don't do things like that in areas that have a small number of black people, and they are much more generous with benefits. They have a formula that was very detailed. I played this on the compensatory call-in, but things like that seem to strongly suggest system of racism, white supremacy, and being rewarded for practicing racism. We've pointed that out consistently, that you can have these all-white towns instead of doing what he said, penalized. You're not going to get federal expenditures. We're not going to give you money. You don't want any Negroes? Fine. No federal funds for you. It's the exact opposite. They get more than their share of federal funds. Continuing, this is all on the same page. Instead of withdrawing state and federal aid from these towns, governments award them prisons and juvenile detention centers to give their economies a boost. I think Dr. Kamau Kamban, Imhon Dicey said he just saw him on the continent. Dr. Kamban has said for decades, this is white welfare. I'm going to read that again. Instead of withdrawing state and federal aid from these towns, governments award them prisons and juvenile detention centers to give their economies a boost. Is this mentioned regularly when people talk about what they call mass incarceration, slavery, Mr. Reed? Is this mentioned that, you know, they just moved to these little all-white enclaves that have probably purged black people or deliberately kept out Negroes, and now the only Negro representation is in greater confinement? Is that mentioned? People can let me know. Economies of boost to penologists, places such as Chehalis, Washington. Oh, that's right here. Wow, I know people that have been there. My goodness. Woo! Chehalis, Washington, Clarinda, Iowa, Izzard County, Arkansas, Pollock, Louisiana, Brown County, Dwight, Pinckneyville, Vandalia, Vienna, and other locations in Illinois. They hit up Illinois. Huge. Pam should have been with us to read this book. Perry County, Indiana, Wayne County, and various other white valleys in Pennsylvania. The Adirondack counties of New York. Garrett County, Maryland, and other places with overwhelmingly white populations seem to be ideal. Pause right there. You cannot give me a whole lot of nonsense about well-meaning whites, race relations, all this other nonsense that he's given us in the text. White people want to do better and it's good for them to be around black people, and then come back and tell me that all white towns are the ideal location to warehouse in greater confinement non-white people, particularly black people. Oh, yeah. All white town? Y'all purged the Negroes 100 years ago and haven't allowed any back in? Great. We will put you a prison here and we will make sure to stuff it full of Negroes. It'll be great. Y'all can all get jobs and come in and call them names and rape them all day long. Are you serious? And again, that should be blown up. Like the way that you write, that cannot be minimized. That cannot be glossed over. In fact, in my view, that should be emphasized. We can cut out all that other fluff and nonsense that they put in about the spruce tree being decorated for Christmas. Who cares? That's what I mean. They get us with a lot of rhetoric and symbolism as though that means something. What would mean something? Hey, Miss Daisy, these here prisons, this is done. They're going to lose all the federal funding and no more prisons for towns as a reward for booting out and keeping out Negroes. That'll be the reward. And, you know, we don't even do Christmas anymore. That white Jesus thing, that's old. We're not. Yeah, that's racism, white supremacy, too. That's how we got here in the first place. So we're not even doing that anymore. Let's see. Ooh, same page, just continuing to read. Governments also often honor sundown towns. At their city limits, sometimes right where the infamous sundown signs used to be. You telling me that's an accident? You had a sign up that said, nigger, don't let the sun hit you in this town or whatever. We had so many of them. Let's see what some of the other ones that I remember. Read, nigger, and run. If you can't read, run. That was one. They had the black mule for an ass. That was one that they had. So you're telling me in a spot that used to have any array of these types of signs, now you have a federally sponsored sign announcing, honoring this location as a gem in the United States of America. And that's just a coincidence that you took that one down and put up this new sign. At their city limits, sometimes right where the infamous sundown signs used to be, now stand congratulatory signs toasting the towns with such designations as Governor's Hometown Award, Illinois Main Street Community, Illinois Certified City, Michigan Educational Excellence Award, U.S. Department of Education Exemplary School, and the like. Surely, no sundown town deserves these awards. I will stop there, but he goes on to give another illustration. Again, maybe that could be said, but it seems obviously that that is not the case. It seems like the sundown towns have no problem racking up awards, honor government. That's so important. It's not even state sanctioned. This is federally sanctioned, probably federally financed recognition and awards for what a swell place this is that just happens to have no niggers since we lynched them all from a tree that's standing right about where this here plaque is now. How about that? The number 605-313-5164, the code 564-943, pound, press star 61 if you would like to participate. And this just corroborates something we've heard before about white supremacy, racism, and infamous acts of terrorism being celebrated. That's the Texas Rangers went out and slaughtered genocide against non-white people. Now they have a baseball team that I think the Bush family supported, might have even been financially involved with. But there are numerous examples of that. Jacqueline Battalora, admitted white supremacist. She's been a guest on this program more than once. She talked about that in detail at the White Privilege Conference and in the archives 2010, and gave a number of different illustrations. We've had other guests who pointed out other examples. The Andrew Jackson, pull out any of your U.S. currency. Slave owners, racists abound. Go all the way up to Benjamin Franklin, the infamous. Other folks who dialed in, hand up if you have comments, questions. Line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, may I be heard?
Greetings, Mr. Demery Four.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and listeners, retired firefighter, and anyone else. I am a happy camper because we are at the end. I just want to start out with the couple that moved into Levittown, you know, that struck me, some interest in me. So I did a little research on that. I guess this guy, old Levitt, you know, racist, confirmed racist, Levitt and son, you know, they decided to build these homes after World War II for the veterans. And then he specifically said, you know, only whites were to move into these homes. So this is supposed to be the beginning of the suburbs. You know, it's like he not only did a development, but he put in like churches and schools, and he made communities, and it was three of them. This couple, you know, moved into one, I think a Jewish person, sold the family, the home, and the terrorism that they had to endure. Crowds across the street and death threats. They were even singing the national anthem outside the home while they threw rocks through their plate glass windows. The cops didn't do anything, and eventually the state police had to intervene. But 14 continuous days of terrorism, phone calls, and threats, death threats, you know. So that little bit that he put in there about him naming a tree after Miss Daisy Myers, you know, it's like you said, it's very tacky, you know, compared to what they endured. And if you could just put yourself in a situation. I was in a situation similar to that one time in my life when I foolishly allowed a white couple to rent a home for me in a rural Texas town. And all the blacks were living in a certain area. That house was on the other side of the track. And make a long story short, after like a 50-foot oak tree came down over the house, I decided to move, you know, because that was just the beginning of the harassment that I was going to endure. But anyway, back to the book. You know, some of the things, you know, that you can take away from this book is like For instance, like the firefighters bringing up, white people try to be the judge on whether racism has even occurred or not. And then they'll decide whether you were harassed or terrorized. They feel like that they know everything. They learn and it's complete. They don't need to know anything because they're white. And when he was talking about de facto and de jure, to me, that's only racism can only be intentional. You know, racism is not unintentional. In other words, when a person practices racism, they know that they're practicing racism. They're not practicing racism by mistake. And this part about liberal whites, you know, versus racist, you know, liberals can be racist also. Nice people can be racist. Good people can be racist. Falsehood about blacks and whites living in proximity of each other is going to somehow help solve the problem of racism, white supremacy. It's just the biggest lie ever told. You know, he talked about the nadir, you know, the time during 1890 and around 1940. You know, it's probably the worst, you know, in this particular part of the planet, you know, what he called race relations. But I guess entity that's between blacks and white, it was at its peak. And during that same time, you know, thousands of black were lynched throughout America. And I was reading somewhere, and Ida B. Wells was talking about there wasn't a single day went by that there wasn't an article written somewhere about a black person being lynched, and that the numbers were incorrect on how many people were actually lynched. So you know, some of these things that he mentioned were just the tip of the iceberg. I thought about the couple found floating in the Detroit River. I don't have a book, so I don't know exactly where it was. I believe it happened in the 50s, around 52 or 53. And let's see. The devaluation of property. You know, the whites use that as an excuse to not sell to blacks. But he gave an example around the end of the book. I think it was Oak Park is a prime example of none of those fears, unsubstantiated fears that they had, were even true. That Oak Park, since blacks had moved in there, the prices went up. You know, all these things that they were talking about did not happen. That tipping point that he's talking about, when you reach 15%, then whites start to take off, you know, white flight. That's probably true. But it's not true that just because a group of people move into your neighborhood that, you know, it's going to be hordes of black people in that particular neighborhood, you know, after that. So that is false. And, you talked about the guy who is supposed to be a upstanding member of the community after they didn't even want him in the area before. But I'll mute my line on that, Gus. Maybe I'll come back a little later with some of these other, because I want to talk about that. That was a tipping point theory when blacks get to about 15%, then the whites take off. Okay, thanks for taking the call.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Ford. Thank you for hanging in there. I hope it was worthy of your time and energy. This was a tad longer than our normal text, but we got to the finish line. Context of white supremacy. Let's see. Other folks, if you dialed in, *61, if you have comments, questions to share, we are all done. James Lowen, Sundown Towns. Let's see. Other callers, proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Nevada.
Hello. Hello to everyone. Thank you for taking my call. I definitely agree with Gus as far as like the ending of the book definitely being important. And I didn't know what type of group it was, so I'm glad that you mentioned that it was some type of rock group, because that kind of shows the lack of seriousness, at least to me, about wanting to resolve the problem. All the people you can quote, all the research that has already been done, even at the time that this, you know, I'm assuming he was researching the book, and you quote a rock group, it does kind of remind me a little bit of Love is a Revolutionary Act, and kind of quoting people who, not necessarily saying that they don't have, you know, any knowledge of a situation, but not necessarily having full knowledge of it, or like, you know, being an expert or anything of that nature. Just the different books that I have read, when it comes to anything that, you know, white people have taken serious, you know, they will actually reference either studies, even if it doesn't have to be a book, it could just be like a study, and they'll reference someone else's book or someone else's study who could be a doctor, what have you. So I definitely think that that's important. And then the whole tree thing, that I think that's just another one of white people's jokes, because they obviously know the correlation between black people and trees or poles or whatever, you know, these evil racist people want to hang someone from, or, you know, torture someone around or what have you. I do, I did appreciate at least, you know, all the different sundown towns mentioned, even learning more about Ohio and kind of understanding more about like how my grandfather had talked about just the different situations that he was in Ohio, and it makes a, it's kind of making a little bit more sense, or helping me to better understand it. And I guess I'll leave it there for now. Thank you.
Much obliged, Red. That's what I said. I felt like I learned quite a bit. Even Washington, I've been saying the whole time, I was totally ignorant about Tillamook dairy products until reading this book. And oh, this is an all white town. And I've been asking other people since we read that, other people that live in Seattle who eat Tillamook cheese and dairy products on a regular basis. Did you know Tillamook is a town in Oregon? And most folks have said no. And then I go for the double whammy. Did you know it was an all white town where they exclusively prohibit Negroes? And they're like, what? Like, yes. That is super. If we can get Mr. Lowen on, I would definitely have to give some major appreciation, because I learned quite a bit about Washington State and a whole lot of other areas that I was very ignorant about. And I think I would encourage anybody, learn a lot about local, state, national history. You can learn quite a bit about racism, white supremacy, global history as well. But just things that happen locally, things that have happened locally, where you, especially if you're in an area where you've been for some period of time, a few years, or if you're close to where you were born, you've kind of been in the same area for a greater part of your life. Oh, yeah. You should know quite a bit of history. You should be, you know, that should be one of your uses of time and energy, in my view, because that would be constructive. If every black person became knowledgeable about at least local state history in their area, like I'm going to be a regular historian, wow, we would have a lot of very informed folks about racism, white supremacy, at least how it's operated in your jurisdiction. Let's see. Draftomania should be with us as well. Did you have comments, questions?
Yes. I had my phone on mute. I apologize. Thanks for taking my call, Gus. Hi, Gus and callers. I did also learn so much from this book, and it did motivate me to do some research on where I reside now, and I've been learning a lot in regards to, you know, my residency now. I had an opportunity to look at some documentaries, and also I heard some towns mentioned from where I'm originally from, and I did not know that these towns were once sundown towns. So as you stated, although the author was practicing racism, white supremacy, I do also agree with that statement. It was still a very informative read. And I had a question. Did you figure out what book we're going to be beginning next week?
Nope. I haven't made up my mind, and people are still making suggestions, so nope.
Okay. Well, wonderful. Whatever book it is, I know I will be enjoying it, as I have been listening to, you know, I think I've caught up with almost every book in the archives, but I recently tried to find Madiba in the archives, but I think YouTube took it down. I don't know if it had something to do with copyright, you know, policies or anything like that, but I did a research on it last week. It was up at one time, but I guess they must have deleted it off of the internet. And another suggestion really quick, I was just doing some research, and New York Times has a, what is it? It's New York Times. It's an anti-racist book reading list. I was looking at something in my email, and there's a list of books. Give me one second, Gus. I'm trying to pull it up. I had it in front of me one second ago. Oh, God. Well,
oh, I found
my
it.
Computer seems... Yeah, you found it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They have, I think they have Warmth of Other Suns. They have some very interesting reads on it.
Oh,
so,
Dorothy Roberts,
you might
she was
look
on the program.
There.
That's
yes!
First one. We
yes.
talked about that book. That's already one ding.
Yes. Yep.
Their eyes...
So
oh, we
as
did
I was
read
listening to that, I'm sorry. As I
the
was
Bluest Eye, they got two of us on here. Wow. Three of us on here. My mm-hmm. goodness. Awesome.
Yes.
Cows is in the building.
Yes. Yes. Yes, sir. I thought you might like it. I got a little excited when I looked at the book list. I said, wow, New York Times has a lot of books that they've read on the book club. So I'm glad I had opportunity to let you know about that. And like I said, I did enjoy the book, and I felt that it was very informative. And, you know, just by doing the research, you know, where you live at and learning the history of the towns, it will educate you to your environment and what, you know, to expect from, you know, from your surroundings and things like that. So I think it's very useful information. And thanks again, Gus, for having this format. And that's all I have.
Much obliged. Thanks for the suggestions. Draftomania, I will share the New York Times list, which folks can check out. Now, I said, hey, racist white supremacists, they are amazing. Now, you already heard Dorothy Roberts is on this list, three-time guest on The Cows. Autobiography of Malcolm X, we read that on the book club. Toni Morrison's Bluest Eye, we read that on the book club. Two of those are in my top five all time, and we did them on the book club. I think there's another one that we did read here as well. But they also got Redefining Realness, Janet Mock, and Sister Outsider, Audre Lorde, that's another cowbell, shrewd, very, very shrewd in how you put a list together. But I will post it nonetheless. It has some constructive information. Oh, there's, yeah, anyway, I'll post the list so you all can check it out at your leisure. *61 if you have comments, questions to add with Paul Robeson. I rang the cowbell there. There could have been multiple because there was a kind of roll call of different so-called presidents, prime ministers, leaders on the continent. And at least one was in a tragic arrangement. So there were multiple reasons. Unfortunately, Mr. Robeson, lengthy career, legendary athlete at Rutgers and entertainer, musician, victim of racism, white supremacy. He is known for playing Othello. He also played Jack Johnson, the boxer. Anyway, he also, James Lowen in Sundown Towns, as we are bidding adieu. He says the whole section where he talks about when white people move into predominantly black neighborhoods, he says in the last 20 years, whites have sometimes moved into majority black neighborhoods. Only people that have neighborhoods are white. You cannot be a victim of white supremacy and have a neighborhood. When this happens, liberals, whatever that means, often cry gentrification. I'm not sure what any of that means. Like, who are you talking about? Because I hear some black people get described as liberals. Like, I'm not really sure who you're talking about. What is a liberal and cry gentrification? What does that mean? See, that would be a question right there. What do you mean exactly, Mr. Lowen? But the resulting class, and that's metaphor, crack, that's one of the words that I recommend people not use when talking about racism, because frequently what I hear is someone is crying racism, which might fit here. If white people are moving in and you got a group of liberals crying racism, gentrification, but the resulting class and racial mix usually lasts for many years, to the betterment of municipal services and the city's tax base. Pause. We'll take an area like Washington, D.C., where that has happened exactly and dispersed the city that used to be predominantly black. Again, the grandsester, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, who was a victim of this very gentrification, where she said all of her black residents, boop, 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 some of them left and didn't even tell her. And she's left there being harassed with all this noise pollution. I don't think that helped black people. And I think a lot of black people said that when they were, quote unquote, crying gentrification. They were pointing out this is just racial dislocation, Mr. Fuller's term. Words are very important. I think Mr. Lowen understands that. But I just thought this was absurd. I was going to say absurd, but this is racism, white supremacy being practiced. And it's not footnoted there. So many times in this book, this dude, do you know how long we have been reading? The footnote section is enormous. If you have the book or if you even just flip through it, it's well researched. He has got tons of material. You said he spent years putting this book together, which I'm not surprised. Then you have a paragraph like this and you have statements like that with no footnotes. Who are you talking about? What are you talking about? This is just opinion that we just have to accept just because you say so. Continuing. Tipping point theory cannot explain gentrification. I don't even know what that means. He doesn't explain the theory. He just assumes that we're supposed to know what that's at minimum. That's sloppy. As a paid freelance journalist, I would not be allowed to just assume that my reading audience knows what this theory is or even knows what my interpretation of this theory is. This is the first time that you're presenting this at the end of a book that has nothing to do with tipping point theory. What is that? Or at least give me your quick explanation on it. And you've used gentrification twice and not explained what that term is either. That's twice. You're just leaving it up to your audience that they know what these terms mean. You're not going to give us a definition. You're not even going to give us an extra sentence to explain any of this. No footnotes either. Nor can it explain Mount Rainier, Maryland, a working class suburb of Washington, D.C., that was 56% black in 1990, 62% in 2000, and probably 59% in 2005. The experiment of living together, said one white newcomer in 2003, as opposed to being polarized as black or white or Latino, makes those labels break down and leaves a whole lot more room for finding common ground. Now, that's just a quote, and there is a footnote for that. Whoopee. That is total nonsense. You're having squabbles over what's going to be included on the census right now. And I believe it was reported that they had questions placed there specific, deliberately to empower white people. And that's what they said, conservatives and white people. And that was widely reported in the Associated Press. I posted it on social media widely. All of that is total nonsense, racism, white supremacy. If that were true, if these labels break down, that's another metaphor, you wouldn't have a census. They just wouldn't go there. We don't have racial classifications. We don't take that off the census for this area because, yeah, we don't even have this. That's not true, I'm sure. He continues on the same page. The pros and cons. Oh, this is in quotes. Sorry. Let's see. DeVaricone visited meetings of Interracial Family Circle, a Washington, D.C. Again, this is a place that has booted out lots of black people. I'm sure that number has changed. It says 59% in 2005. I'd be curious. I'll check before we go off the air. What's that number now in 2019? Because I know the number of black people has dropped substantially in Washington, D.C. since the time this book was published approximately 15 years ago. The pros and cons of different neighborhoods are constant topics of conversation, she wrote. She quoted the group's president, Nancy Lee Knox. People want to be where it's diverse. Everyone talks about it as being the primary criterion. Knox and her husband are white, but have two black adopted sons. We want our children to live where there are lots of different kinds of people, Knox said. It turns out lots of people are like Knox. Pause right there. A white family that adopted two Negro children. It turns out lots of people are like Knox. That is a lie. In fact, there's data from Dorothy Roberts, who I just said three-time guest on The Cows. I quoted her. She did come on The Cows to talk about Fatal Invention, which is about medicine and racism, white supremacy. However, she was also on the program to talk about Shattered Bonds, which is white supremacy in social welfare. And I mean, wow, she is intense, accurate, and she would say for a fact, James Lowen, that is a lie. Most white people are not like the Knox because most white people do not want nigger children. That's why white children are so expensive. That's why I play the sound clip on the compensatory call-in. Black babies cost less because white people are not like the Knox family. They do not want black children. That's why there are so many of them in the social service system. Flagrant lie. And I mean, hey, I'm Gus T. Renegade. I'm not a well-published author, victim of racism, white supremacy. I've not been able to take 15 years to study and travel the lands and do research. Mr. Lowen has a lot more education and he's older than I am, so he has more expertise. I'm sure he already knows this. If he's been hanging out and researching Medgar Evers, I'm sure he already knows about white supremacy, racism in social services, child and health welfare. Flagrant lie. That would be an, and I mean, that's such a tacky example that this is going to be your presentation of well-meaning white people, a white couple that adopts two black children and moves into Washington, D.C. These are the people that were making things difficult for Dr. Welsing, directly and or indirectly, the influx of these folks with their adopted Negro children. Now, how am I, again, if I was confused about racism, white supremacy, I might read this. I don't know how I'd process that. Even at a confused state, something just seems, at minimum, bizarre. How am I to feel about a white couple adopting black children and moving to Chocolate City? And this is the beacon of, yes, well-meaning white people who are not racist. How did you come to get these children in the first place? What happened to their parents? Maybe they were victims of the purge, too. Did I know Mr. Demery Ford said he had perhaps comments on this tipping point matter. Did any other folks have comments? I thought this was pretty significant. Maybe it was just me. Before I lose it, on the same page, after he's talking about the Knox transracial abduction, that's the article that I wrote, what this is. So transracial abduction, a librarian in Decatur, my central Illinois hometown, spoke with pride of his interracial neighborhood in the West End, which had been a sundown neighborhood when I grew up. And there's a gay couple on the block and no one thinks anything about it. And he has an exclamation point to end the quotation. Talk about extra double whammy tacky. How does that relate to, I haven't heard any illustrations at all, not one. Now, he's deviated to talk about Jews being kept out, Asian people being kept out, Sikhs being kicked out, other non-white people, so-called Mexicans, Latinos, blah, blah, blah. I have not heard one sentence in this book about LGBT people, there being signs saying, you know, faggot, read, and run. I have not heard one incident of that. I think he's mentioned them before and saying somehow that areas that are more tolerant of gays are more tolerant of black people or something of that nature, but I haven't heard anything even remotely comparable between white supremacy racism and there being gay people present. What does that have to do with anything? And the fact that you would include that as an anecdote in your text, I'm sure that he researched and talked to dozens of people. You thought that that was worthy, that was so significant, salient, accurate representation of what's happening to include that. We're proud of having, and even you slipped that word pride in because they got Pride Week here in Seattle and across the country. They got Pride Week, probably in D.C. too. But to slip that in first, that the librarian spoke with pride about this being a quote-unquote interracial neighborhood, and there's a gay couple on the block and no one thinks anything about it. Folks, all good on that point. Any other questions, thoughts they want to make sure they get in on Mr. Lowen's work?
I did have a comment about that. It seems like he is using the gay couple on the block because at least by what you're saying, it didn't seem like he spoke of their race, or did he?
He did not.
Okay, so I can only assume that they are likely white because usually whenever I hear, I guess I can assume, but, you know, of course we don't know, but when I hear people talking about the LGBTQ+ community, they like to remove race unless it's for their benefit, especially when white men, gay white men, or, you know, gay plus white men, you know, mention that. So it kind of reminds me of just also incorporating women. So he might as well just also say women, i.e. white women. You know, there, you know, some white women on the block, single white women. And so, you know, that's really progressive. It's like, this does not show, what does this have, just like you were saying, what does this have to do with racism? They act as if white women don't practice racism. And just because of who you're having, what you do, you know, behind closed doors or your Area 8 activity does not remove your racism. So I definitely, you know, disagree with that being a part of that being, you know, them showing their progressive nature or liberal nature or what have you. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged. Red in Nevada. Actually had a few more highlights. I'll dig in and check, see if other folks have questions. He also wrote, desegregating independent sundown towns benefits their residents, i.e. whites, especially their children, by lessening their unease about the interracial outside world and expanding their options for college vacations and places to live and work. If he is talking about white people here, I have never seen any evidence that white people are uneased about the quote-unquote interracial outside world, whatever that means. I've seen no evidence of that at all. He said he's lived in predominantly black areas. He just mentioned the Knox couple. He didn't say that they were had unease about getting a Negro child or moving to Washington, D.C. I didn't hear that. How does this quote unquote gentrification happen if so many white people have unease about moving into predominantly Negro areas? That is hogwash. And the rest of it, for vacations and all of that, I just heard a bus full of white people right here in Seattle who were planning out their summer vacations to Japan, China, areas with lots of non-white people. I did not hear any unease about going to a quote unquote interracial area or a place that did not have a whole lot of white people. That is total nonsense in the system of racism, white supremacy. How could you have South Carolina plantations where you would have hundreds of niggers on a plantation and five white people? How could that be? Where is their racial unease? They're still dominating. He continues. So he says, once you have these quote unquote desegregated areas, he says more than 90% of a sample of high school juniors in Louisville, Kentucky, Muhammad Ali, for example, say they are comfortable working with students of another race. I don't even know what that means. Were they comfortable working with another race on the plantation? Continuing, whites and blacks also feel they can discuss racial issues across racial lines. I, again, have no idea what that means. And generally speaking, if any sort of accurate dialogue is happening, now, if it's just going to be racism, white supremacy, and there are no definitions and everybody is a little racist, if it's that sort of dialogue, oh, yeah, we can talk all day and we feel great. Tell us how you feel and I'll tell you how I feel. Absolutely. No problem. If we're going to be honest, system of racism, white supremacy, this is not going to be about race relations. We're going to talk about white supremacy, racism, white power, and what can be done to dismantle that. Oh, I can guarantee that they will not, no one, whites or non-whites, will feel they can comfortably discuss these issues across racial lines. I can guarantee that. If anyone, you know, can speak to the contrary, do not be silent. On the same page, he says, merely encountering African-Americans as neighbors, PTA members, and so on can improve white rhetoric. I want to say that again because I changed my highlight color for that. One of the most important lines in the book, merely encountering African-Americans as neighbors, PTA members, and so on can improve white rhetoric. He didn't say white commitment to ending racism. He didn't say can improve authentic white concern for black people, African-Americans. He didn't say that. He said can improve white rhetoric. Marimba Ani, the book club on display. Dr. Marimba Ani Yorugu, she said, rhetorical ethic, one of the most important concepts in the book, basically how white people lie, where they can promote a certain ethos, certain set of beliefs, values, democracy. Yes, we believe in, you know, ending racism. We stood with Madiba. Yes, voted for Obama three times, in fact. They can say all of that publicly and fool a lot of people into thinking that that's what it is. And that's not the case at all. They practice, support, believe in the religion of white supremacy, rhetorical ethic. This important, in my view, if you understand, just being around black people, white people get better at refining their ability to lie and speak to black people as though they're not racist. And that might be our author, Mr. Lowen, who admitted, I read the footnote where he said he's lived around black people in Mississippi and Washington, D.C., spent years, was buddies with them. That might be what we have here, a white man who has improved his rhetoric so that he can fool a lot of non-white people into thinking that he's not racist. Either way, very important sentence. I'll read the whole sentence. He says, merely encountering African-Americans as neighbors, PTA members, and so on can improve white rhetoric because social and political discussions are impoverished by the absence of African-Americans. On today's program, we heard black, Afro-American, African-American. If anybody can tell me the difference between someone classified as black, someone classified as Afro-American, someone classified as African-American, and someone classified as nigger. If you can distinguish and tell me what the difference is between those different classifications, because we've heard all of them in this book, in fact, or except Afro-American, and that was mentioned in the audio clip at the beginning about this problem in Tucson. That would educate me if there's a distinction. On the same page, he says, we have seen that sundown towns both collect and create racists, while integrated towns, whatever that means, both collect and create anti-racists. Again, there's no footnote. You're a liar, James Lowen. You're not supposed to name call, but this is a flagrant lie. Like, this is one that's almost like, no, you should wear the title liar. Produce the anti-racists. We're in a system of racism, white supremacy, Mr. Lowen. You don't even count in my book. Produce the anti-racists. Name the first white person. In fact, give us a definition. What do you have to do to qualify to be an anti-racist? Write a book? Come on. What do you got to do? Give me name number one. John Brown doesn't even count. Let's strike that before we even get started. Give me name number one. That's an anti-racist. And integrated towns both collect and create anti-racists? I mean, that is like, you deserve the title liar. Which town is that that has created? Name town number one. Where? Where are we talking about? You didn't even name that town in the book. Anybody else have a question? I mean, that's like substantial. Did that stand out to anybody else?
Yes. That stood out to me. Can I be here?
Yes, sir, Mr. Demery Ford.
Oh, let the female guest go. I'll come in later.
Oh, right on.
I'm sorry. I'll be quick. I didn't. I agree because he's citing different really broad ideas and not providing any footnotes. Not, I know some of the footnotes there are just like emails from different random white people, but the thing about it is that he's also contradicting himself, because he also said that white people move out of the suburbs, and I remember saying this before, white people move out of these the cities where they have more access to, you know, non-white people, to go back to the suburbs for whatever reason, whether they're getting older, or one of the things that I feel like is if they have children and they want their children to have better access to school, have access to better schools, and that's not something that's readily available in their soon to be fully gentrified neighborhood. So they're not technically moving into these neighborhoods, they're gentrifying them. So I don't believe that at all. White people are taking the racism no matter where they go. I'll mute my line.
Okay, yes, just what you were saying, Gus, that interracial family circle, I wanted to say, is still in existence. I looked it up. They still have a working address here in Washington, D.C. And he was leading to the fact that if you're living in an integrated town, that somehow that's going to make a white person liberal or anti-racist. And we all know that, you know, that's laughable. you really need the other or black people around so that they can practice racism. So, and like you said, 75%, over 75% of them do not want to live with black people. But I want to ask you a question, Gus, if you could. You got, can you tell how many times the author actually said in the book, nigger, don't let the sun go down on you in this town? That had to be over at least 30 times, I know, that exact phrase. I'll mute my line.
I'm putting it in right now to see if we can get a count on how many times that phrase pops up in the book. It seems like it was said many times throughout the text. So, yeah, we'll while I'm getting our count for Mr. Demery for, any other folks have questions, comments they wanted to make sure they get in? Our last session on Mr. James Loewen, Sundown Towns.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I guess kind of going off of that same question that Mr. Demery Ford asked, on that same theme, it seemed like it was redundant. It was constantly the same sign, no matter how small the town was. That was something that I was kind of wondering about it. Like, it didn't matter whether it was, you know, in Ohio or Indiana or whatever, or even the Ozarks, he kept referencing that same sign. And it kind of made it seem like it was a little bit unbelievable, unless, you know, there's some, you know, factory of at that time, and I'm being facetious, but, you know, some type of factory where it's like, okay, they're literally producing the same sign with the same verbiage. I kind of thought that was a little odd. I'll mute my line.
All right. So Mr. Demery Four, he said 30 times he would be correct. It is in the book a total of 35 times, and only two of those times are in the footnotes. So we actually heard it in the body of the text 33 times since we've been reading the book. Some variation of "Nigger, don't let the sun go down on you." 35 times total in the book, 33 times in the body of the text. I don't know if it means that they did have a factory. I don't know what it means. But when I spoke to Mr. Fuller, as I did send him this book, I tried to ring him to see if he had a final thought, if he had a chance to read it over, but I wasn't able to catch him. But when I did speak with him previously, before he had the book in hand, he did say that he remembered that sign in Oklahoma. And that's the one that he said, "Nigger, don't let the sun go down." That was the one that he said. So I don't know. It might be evidence to suggest that, yeah, it was just that widespread. And he says in the book that the sundown towns, that there were, you know, maybe thousands of them. So, yeah, maybe you did have thousands of these signs. And maybe that, hey, white people do swap racist jokes and racist stories. "Nigga, don't let the sun go down." That sounds pretty good. We'll put that one up too. Any other folks, question, thought, observation as we wrap up Mr. Loewen's Sundown Towns?
One last thing. I know the other female caller, I think that might have been Draftomania, she had referenced the other books. There are different websites that have Cal's archives. There's one called archives.org. I listened to some other archive shows just by Googling the Cal's archives, and you have to put the and then c.o.w.s archives. And then there's also one on TalkShoe, just to let you all know. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged for that. Red in Nevada, lots of archives, SoundCloud as well, should have all of the current information, Black Talk Radio Network as well. I'm thinking the Madiba archive should be there as well, but I'll double check once we get off the air. Any other folks with?
I guess that was a documentary mentioned. I just want to make sure I got the name right. And was it The Long Shadow, a documentary on racism?
The documentary was mentioned in this book?
Let's see. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, one of the callers mentioned, one of the male callers, I believe, I didn't get a chance to look it up. I just wanted to verify the name of that documentary, but maybe I can listen back over the archives and find out. It was in the earlier broadcast.
Oh, okay.
Around the time talking about the KKK visiting West Frankfort, and I think it was more at that rally than the entire population of the town or something like that.
Huh. I'm not sure if it was in the text. I'm doing a search of the text right now, and let's see. That's what you think it was? The Long Shadow?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. I don't see it in the book. Anybody here? Does that sound familiar? Did somebody hear a documentary or that? Does that title sound familiar? The Long Shadow? Alrighty. Yeah, I didn't sound immediate. Let's see. Wait a minute. Oh, it looks like there is a documentary. I see the page for it. It's supposed to deal with slavery. I see it online. Came out in 2017, is this? Came out, I guess, 2017, it looks like. Yeah, 2017, I see it online. I don't know if, I guess it couldn't have been mentioned in this book since it came out in 2017. So I don't know if somebody else mentioned it or whatever the case. But yes, it is. It has a website, thelongshadowfilm.com. You can go to the website and get more information.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yes, sir. I didn't even know about this. Like, wow, did I miss that completely? I know he did mention quite a few, some other documentaries on racism, white supremacy as we were reading. But The Long Shadow, check it out online. Let us know if you find it to be of constructive value. If you have any other thoughts, questions on Mr. Lowen's Sundown Towns as we get ready to wrap up the book, all done, moving on to a new book for next week. If you have suggestions for the book club, you can email untiljustice@gmail.com and we'll review. I will make a selection. Emmy was, I won't say insistent, but she was enthusiastic about The Gift of Fear. I think Draftomania had seconded that book earlier, was thinking about that. I think there's already an audiobook for that one as well. So I'll give it a ponder. If you have a suggestion, you can drop an email, or if you have a vote, drop an email, and I will try to make a decision as early as possible so that people, if you want to get a hard copy of the book to prepare and read along with, you'll have time to do so. Hopefully we'll pick a book that'll be easy to obtain. If we have anyone that wants to narrate The Judas Factor, I don't know if we could do that next because I don't even have a physical copy of that book, even though I've already read it. I got it at the University of Washington library here. I guess if push came to shove, I probably could scan that book and then narrate it, but that's like, oof, that's a lot of work. That's a lot of work. Judas Factor is a very good book, Assassination of Malcolm X. I would definitely recommend that folks read it, but oof, that's a lot of work. Yeah, I'd be willing to scan it. If somebody was willing to narrate, I would be willing to scan. I could do that. That would still be a good bit of time and energy to scan the whole book, but that would be a worthwhile cause. If you would be willing to narrate, email untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. Let's see. Any other folks, comments, questions they want to share on the text?
Yes, Gus. Mike, when I mentioned the Judas Factor last week, I told you after reading that book, that's on my top 10. You know, that's all I wanted to share. Enjoyed the book thoroughly. It's a great book. And thank you. Only reason why I know about that book is, as I stated, from listening to the autobiography of the story with Malcolm and Muhammad Ali. what is the name of that
brothers? Blood
keeper,
Brothers.
Or what is it? Blood Brothers, yes, yes. And you kept mentioning the book, and I found the book, was able to download it via PDF free. So that's how I was able to read the book. And that's all I have.
Outstanding. Glad you were able to. I know that one is a more difficult book to obtain. That's another reason I probably wouldn't want to read it next week, because I don't think that's one that you could just go to the local library and get easily, or whatever your local bookstore is. That might be one people would have to order or scrounge around for. But Carl Evans is the author of Black Male. Excellent book. Mentioned some of the very people when a retired firefighter, when he gave his list of people that were influenced by Paul Robeson. Quite a few of those folks also are mentioned in The Judas Factor, and talking about some of the same enemies of Paul Robeson were enemies of Minister Malcolm, who was also greatly influenced by Paul Robeson. Minister Malcolm was at his funeral, I believe. And some of the very people that were mentioned, Leopold Sedar Senghor, and many of the others, Patrice Lumumba, Kwame Nkrumah, mm-hmm. many of the other folks, same enemies that Malcolm X had, same enemies that Paul Robeson had, were the same enemies that they had. And the Judas Factor, I think, makes that point. And it might even mention Paul Robeson as well. It's been minutes since I've met it, but I'd be stunned if Paul Robeson didn't at least get a footnote in Judas Factor. But
Gus, I just wanted to say one thing. You can download it for free on PDF. Go to Google it, book, put PDF, and you will be able to get the book for free.
All right, on. That's great. If it's that accessible.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter, yes, sir.
Yes. The Judas Factor is another book that I would recommend also. Excellent book. On the subject of the murder of Malcolm X. Excellent book. I have it in my library.
It's a great one to have. I wish I had the actual physical copy in my library as well, but I'm glad to have read it. Reading is more important than watching television. And that's another reason why generally I don't have like a book list. I have just my top 10 of, you know, books that I really enjoyed. But I don't really have like a book list because there's so many things to read and books are constantly coming out. Just read. That's identical answer to what Dr. Welsing gave. Just try to read as much as you can about lots of different things. Try to learn as much as you can. The racism, white supremacy will be there directly and or indirectly. Any other comments pertaining to Sundown Towns before we call it a broadcast?
I would just say it became a Sundown Town after the terrorism and massacre that took place in Ocoee, Florida. I informed my brother, who stays in Ocoee, Florida, that the city of Orlando just recognized, whatever that means, recognized the Ocoee massacre that took place in that town. It was something like in the early 20th century, somewhere around that time where it took place. But I just saw it on NPR, heard it on NPR, where the city of Orlando, quote unquote, recognized the Ocoee massacre.
Much obliged. They probably gave, I see it. Yep. Commemorating July Perry and addressing the history of racial terrorism. Are they going to say terrorism or race relations? Let's see. Racial violence. How about that? Commemorating July Perry and addressing the history of racial violence in Central Florida. And they have a big plaque that says the lynching of July Perry. Let's see. Let's see what it says.
And they probably planted a tree also.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's going to be the new Christmas decoration. We'll have fresh popcorn and oranges to hang on the tree in commemoration
right.
of Mr. Perry. Let's see. On Friday, An historic marker was unveiled outside the Orange County Historic Center in Orlando commemorating July Perry. Perry was lynched during the Okoye massacre in November 1920, a wave of violence in which up to 30 black residents of Okoye were killed and the town was burned by a white mob. I suspect it was a lot more than 30, but okay. The marker is a reminder of the horror of what happened in Okoye and the decades of racial terror. Hey, Mr. Lowen didn't. This is only two paragraphs and they got terror in there. He wrote a whole book and barely got it in there. Decades of racial terror that gripped the South. So what does this commemoration say about how far this community has come and how much work there is left to do in the path of racial equality? Community, there's that. We're joining the intersection for a discussion about what it means to this legacy of racial violence in Central Florida. Oh, and they have a group of people on that'll sit and chat about Mr. Perry and the orange tree they planted in commemoration of all this. But yeah, that was just this week, right there down in Central Florida. Lots of this all over the United States. And maybe you get an apology and a plaque. Maybe you don't. Any other thoughts, questions? Thankful that we're done with Mr. Lowen. Whoopee. Did anybody read Lies My Teacher Told Me? I remember that was such a popular book. I remember so many of people that I was around just thought that was one of the greatest books. And oh, you've got to read it. It's so great. You've got to read it. You've got to read it. And I was not swayed. I'll take that as a no. I don't know if I would be interested in reading it at this point. Maybe if he decided to come on the program, I would give it a gander just to see where he talks about racism and how he talks about racism in that book. But either way, I will drop him a line again and see if he's interested in chatting with us since he, I think, knows we read the book. Maybe he'll change his mind, but I'll at least ask and report back, see if I hear back from him. We will be here tomorrow for Workplace Racism, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We will go over details, strategies for dealing with terrorism in the workplace. Even I can speak for myself, preparing to go out and do some local teaching in Seattle this summer and just trying to minimize conflict and also working to promote other non-white instructors so that people don't have to go to white studios or racist instructors and deal with all of that, where we can promote non-white instructors directly. That has been a hoot. So I can speak from personal experience for workplace racism and some of the things that I think are helpful. I guess that might count as being self-employed, but strategies I think would work even if you are working directly for racist or someone else. But Workplace Racism tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Tune in, share if you are having difficulties or if you figured out some things that work well to solve problems in the workplace. We'll also be here for the compensatory call-in Saturday, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. If you have a suggestion, again, for the book club, just drop an email. Do it sooner than later, I reckon. I was looking at some of the young, because they have a lot of summer reading lists right now. That's a popular thing. I saw there were a number of young adult summer reading lists, and I was thinking maybe we could do like one young adult book per year as well, since we did The Hate U Give last year. I thought that was really important to check some of those. I think some of the young adult books were also dealing with racism too. So I'll flip through some of those if you find anything that stands out that you think would be good. UntilJustice@gmail.com. Anybody else or everyone satisfied for this evening? We'll assume folks are all good. Whew. Wipe my brow. Thankful to be done with James Lowen's Sundown Towns. I am very glad that I read it. Wow. Learned a lot, but yes, glad to be moving on. I generally am satisfied when we finish a book. Like, all right, that went down. Move on to something else. Hope we learned something that we can apply and appreciate all that time invested. Thanks for everyone who participated. If you listened live, listened to the archives, people that wrote in, I think I tried to read the commentaries as we were moving along, people that have been writing emails as well. continue. We move on to the next book. We will do the same. Add your commentary if anything is worthwhile. Thanks. Keep the reading up. If you find anything grand, please share. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. That is the correct word for what all of this is. It would be grand to keep our brain computers working in optimal conditions so that we can think and come up with a permanent solution. If whites are dedicated to the religion of white supremacy racism, all the evidence, including what we got from Mr. Lowen's text, would suggest that that is the case. We will need all of our immense brain power to go about solving this problem. The narcotics poisons will stymie that effort. At least slow it down and we can get this problem solved ASAP. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. And let's stay off the cell phone if we are driving. That is an easy one race soldiers use to cause us a lot of problems and take up our time. No cell phone while you are driving. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.